Welcome to the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized today's event in coordination with the Arts Forum as well. And we welcome our radio and online audiences and our large noon audience here in San Francisco to hear Ross King, the author of Leonardo and the Last Supper, talking about what he uncovered as to what the history of it is and some of the new things that has been learned about how this was created recently. And Ross is also the author of a book on Michelangelo and also The Judgment of Paris. So, Ross.
Thank you, George. It's great to be back in San Francisco. I'm just at the beginning of my Leonardo tour. I started last night in Pasadena. I was supposed to start on the weekend in New York, but for obvious reasons, that fell through. And someone told me the other day that having to come to California because of a natural disaster is a strange irony. Anyway, let's hope we're okay in the time that we're here. What I want to do is talk a little bit about Leonardo, a little bit about the painting and how the two of them came together, because in some ways it was an uneasy fit. The image of the Last Supper, a segment of which you see up on the screen, is familiar to all of us. It's sort of entered our cultural DNA. One of the great Leonardo scholars of the 20th century, Kenneth Clark, said that it's as familiar to everyone as the boot shape of Italy on a map. Virtually everyone in the Western world could identify the painting and the painter. They might not know where it was painted, when it was painted, why it was painted, who it was painted for, etc., but they could identify Leonardo in the Last Supper. And so it's become part of our popular culture, and like so many other things that are part of our popular culture, it's become prey to popular culture. At the very top of the screen, you see an Andy Warhol. Andy did 40 Last Supper paintings and silk screens in the last year of his life in 86, 87. He was working on them just before he died. And below that, and he was inspired, incidentally, not by the painting itself, which he couldn't really see because it was undergoing restoration at that time. He was influenced by the Last Supper painting that hung in the Warhol family home in Pittsburgh. His mother, they were great Polish Catholics, and his mother had the Last Supper on the wall in the kitchen. And so Andy identified food, kitchen, Last Supper. And so it's very appropriate that the man who made his name with Campbell's soup and Coke should paint what he called a dining scene. He called this Leonardo's dining scene. And at the bottom, the Simpsons, nothing is truly part of popular culture until it's pastiched in The Simpsons, and here the body and blood of Christ have been turned into a bowl of peanuts and a pint of beer. Things get slightly more outlandish. You can be buried in a Last Supper coffin if you want. You could have the image painted on the outside of it. You can have it carved on the outside. But the one I like, bottom right, you can have it on the inside of the coffin so that you can contemplate it for eternity. And then you can also get Last Supper tattoos. And I should point out, this isn't me. I'm not willing to suffer that much for my art. Apparently that took 15 hours worth of needles to do it. And it's actually a very good reproduction of the Last Supper. Right down to the very bottom, you can see the door frame that he's put into it. And I'll talk at the end a little bit about that door frame. Anyway, the Last Supper is something, as I've said, that an image that all of us know. But the history of how it came to be painted and Leonardo's circumstances at the time that he painted it are far less well known. And so what I wanted to do when I began writing this book was to give a kind of up on the scaffold, in the studio, behind the scenes story of how Leonardo created his masterpiece. And one of the things that I had to do as I was writing was deal with the way in which Leonardo himself is an icon, like his work of art. And he, too, has entered the popular imagination as an iconic figure that about whom there are all sorts of preconceptions and, frankly, misconceptions as well. And I didn't exactly want to overturn all of these, but what I wanted to do was to look at Leonardo very closely as an artist, and then maybe even more especially as a man, and a man who was a product of his times. So what I wanted to do is to look at how the work was done at a particular period in history by a particular man who was at a particular point in his own life. Because I think these are things we tend to forget with great works of art. We abstract them from the conditions in which they were created. And we forget that there was a time when the Last Supper was not a done deal, when it wasn't clear to everyone that it was going to be a masterpiece, or indeed that it was even going to be finished. And so what I wanted to do was to rewind 500 years back through all of the myths that grew up about Leonardo in the painting and sort of begin at year zero of the painting and look at the way it took shape on the wall of Santa Maria della Grazia at a particular time in Leonardo's career. And in many ways, what I discovered as I was doing the research for this is that it's almost an accidental masterpiece, because the logistical procedures and difficulties that Leonardo faced and his own temperament and personality made it so that this is a kind of accidental masterpiece that was achieved against a series of odds that, if you were a betting man in 1494, you wouldn't have wagered the mortgage that Leonardo was going to overcome. Because he did have great difficulties with it. I'll say a few words then about Leonardo, and I want to concentrate on one thing in particular. He started the work in 1494 when he was 42 years old. At that time, and I think for us, Leonardo was such an almost superhuman figure that we imagine that there was absolutely nothing he couldn't do. He defines what a Renaissance man is, someone who could turn his hand almost effortlessly to anything. And one of my great surprises as I worked on the book was to realize that Leonardo was not as effective as he thought he could be in various of his pursuits. For example, he was not the most accomplished painter in Italy in 1494, or the most well-known by any means, because in just before he started the Last Supper, the cathedral fathers in Orvieto decided that they were going to get some fresco work done in the cathedral in Orvieto, north of Rome. And so they began casting about for likely candidates and drawing up a list of who they wanted to paint. And they put at the very top Pietro Perugino, a painter from Perugia who'd worked a lot in Florence and was an exact contemporary of Leonardo da Vinci. And they said he is the best master in Italy. Leonardo wasn't on the list of great painters. A couple of years later, a similar thing happened with a banker from Siena named Agostino Chigi, who was a very wealthy and very astute patron of the arts. And Chigi made his own top list of the great painters in Italy. And he said the number one painter is Perugino, and so Perugino holding at number one. And then the second best is Pinturicchio, and there is no third. There are just these two guys, and then everyone else is a tier down from that. And he doesn't mention Leonardo da Vinci, nor did the cathedral fathers in Orvieto. And in fairness to them, and I should point out that Chigi was a very wise and discerning patron of the arts, he later became a great patron of Raphael, in fairness to them, Leonardo had not really given them anything by the time he was 42 years old, that they could point to and say, ah, yes, this puts him up in the pantheon of great Italian painters of the 15th century, because he did suffer from a distinct lack of achievements. And in fact, he had a reputation by this time of not finishing everything that he started. He would hover endlessly over his work, studying it, reworking it, or putting it aside for months at a time before going back to it and finishing it or not. One of his famous quotes is, art is never finished, only abandoned. And in fact, he did abandon quite a few works. And you get the sense that if you commissioned Leonardo to do a painting for you, you had to prize it out of his hands after a couple of years and get it away from him, because there was always one more thing he was going to do to that painting to make it better. And, of course, he could make it better. He could do wonderful work, but he just was continually distracted. So much so that in the mid-1480s, a poet in Florence said that Leonardo had worked for the previous 10 years without creating barely a single work of art. And that's something of an exaggeration, because Leonardo did some very good works of art, probably most conspicuously by the mid-1480s, his portrait of Ginevra de Benci, which is now in the National Gallery of Art in Washington. And then a little later, The Lady with an Ermine, the portrait of Cecilia Gallerani, the mistress of the Duke of Milan. He could do wonderful work if he was motivated or if he was forced to do it, but for every one of these works that he completed, there were two or three of these that he didn't finish or sometimes didn't even get around to starting. And most famous of that is probably the Adoration of the Magi, which is in the Uffizi, if you've been there in Florence. It would have been the greatest altarpiece of the 15th century had he finished it. His father, who was an influential notary, helped him get the job. He was a young jobbing painter at this time, and his father pulled a few strings. He was the notary for a band of monks, and he said, I've got a son, why don't I have him paint you an altarpiece? And Leonardo began the altarpiece and began it with great gusto. It's extremely ambitious, and it was going to be a wonderful work of art, but he abandoned it after probably less than a year on the job. And this is something that happened repeatedly with him, so much so that he himself became aware of his lack of accomplishments, and his notes are peppered with expressions like, I have wasted my hours, or tell me, to which the answer is a qualified yes, or tell me if I ever did a thing, because he did a lot, but he could never do everything that he wanted. And one of his problems with painting is that in his heart of hearts, he did not actually want to be a painter. He wanted to do other things. And in fact, it's revealing that in the 1490s, when he was at work on the Last Supper, a friend of his said, whenever Leonardo should have been attending to his painting, he was doing other things, specifically geometry, astronomy, and architecture. These were fields in which he wanted to excel, and not in painting. He thought big. He wanted to make his name with architecture, civil engineering, or military engineering. And so with that in mind, at the age of 30, in 1482, he left Florence, leaving behind him smoldering various commissions such as the Adoration of the Magi. And he went to Milan armed with a letter of introduction, a kind of letter of credentials to the Duke of Milan, or the man who became the Duke a number of years later, Lodovico Sforza, a very devious, manipulative, unscrupulous politician who usurped his nephew, the true Duke of Milan, to take that position over for himself. Leonardo thought, this is a man with whom I can work. He didn't want to work for the monks and friars or even the wool merchants of Florence. He wanted to work for essentially a prince, the Duke of Milan. And so he wrote his what's essentially a resume telling everything that he could do. And in some ways, it's one of the first resumes in history. And like many subsequent ones, it exaggerates his capabilities because in it he describes his abilities to do things that he has, at the very best, extremely limited experience of, and at worst, absolutely none whatsoever. And so, for example, what he's saying in this letter is that he can he can blow up castles. And Leonardo in 1482 had never blown up a castle. He said he could build bombs that he could be flung into the ranks of the enemy like a hailstorm. And he'd never done anything like that. He'd never been on the field of battle. He said he could build underground tunnels that could twist and turn and pass under rivers and under moats. And so he could go through them and attack your enemy. He said he could build fire-throwing engines, all of this stuff. He was essentially dreaming of being a military engineer and creating weapons of mass destruction to wipe out the enemy. Only at the very end of this letter does he say that he's able to do a couple of other things. He says, I can carry out sculpture in marble, bronze, and clay. And that is true. He is able to do that because he studied under a man named Verrocchio, who was probably the best bronze smith and sculptor of his generation. But he then also adds to it at the very end, and in painting I can do any kind of work as well as any man, whoever he may be. And we think, well, of course he could. He's Leonardo da Vinci. But in fact, he couldn't do every kind of painting as well as any man because he had a very specific blind spot. He had never done a fresco, nor had Verrocchio. Verrocchio was primarily a sculptor who dabbled in painting, and Leonardo helped him with some of his paintings, but Verrocchio had never worked in fresco, and therefore Leonardo had never worked in fresco. And so he, once again, he's fudging things. He's lying a little bit about his capabilities. Anyway, and I'll talk a little bit more about fresco in a few minutes, what happens then is when he fetches up in 1482 at the court of Lodovico Sforza, and he is taken on by Lodovico, who uses him not for weapons of mass destruction or anything like that, but to design costumes and stage scenery. And in effect, he becomes a special effects guy for Lodovico Sforza, Lodovico's court spectaculars, in which he has people flying through the air and landing on the stage, etc. Leonardo, we may see this as a kind of dissipation of Leonardo's genius and talents, but in fact, Leonardo seemed to enjoy doing that quite a lot, because obviously you could see the great pleasure it gave to everyone in the audience. The other thing he got, though, was going to give him more immortality, because of course, by their nature, the theatrical costumes, etc., were ephemeral, but he was going to do something that was truly going to make his name for posterity. And that was a 23-foot-high bronze equestrian monument that was going to honor the father of Lodovico Sforza, Francesco Sforza, who had been a soldier. He was the son of a woodcutter who became a mercenary. Francesco became a mercenary and married the illegitimate daughter of the Duke of Milan, who had no legitimate sons, a Visconti Duke of Milan. And after the death of the last Visconti, he took over the city and Francesco and became the first Sforza Duke of Milan. He was then going to be celebrated by his son, Lodovico, who wanted this statue done. And what a statue it was going to be. We don't know exactly what Lodovico wanted, but Leonardo wanted something gargantuan, colossal, 23 feet high. You can see the audacious pose that he initially thought of. He later changed the design when he saw this was going to be incredibly difficult. But it was going to be an equestrian monument with a rearing horse. Nothing that size had ever been done, and nothing that pose had ever been done. And so it was going to be something that made Leonardo's reputation for all time, essentially. It would testify to the glory of Francesco Sforza and the Sforza dynasty, but even more especially to the genius of Leonardo da Vinci, the man who created it. And this was universally judged impossible. People who saw his plans, including Lodovico, doubted his abilities to do it. But Leonardo himself said, we should not let ourselves not desire the impossible. We should try to do the impossible. And that's what he was going to try to make his name doing. And in fact, this is probably more the reason that he came to Milan, even more than the weapons of mass destruction. He wanted this commission. He got it then and spent the better part of 10 years on it, making numerous designs, trying to figure out how he was going to cast it. And in the summer of 1494, a dozen years after he came to Milan, he was finally ready to begin casting it. He had 75 tons of bronze that were earmarked for the monument, and he lost it because events intervened. You can see how large it was going to be. This was cast 500 years later. It's one of the later poses. It was done by a Japanese sculptor and bronze smith, Nina Akamu. That you can see the way it would have been absolutely spectacular, the size of it. It would have put everything done by the ancient Greeks and Romans in the shade. But Leonardo lost the opportunity to do it in 1494 when war broke out between some of the Italian states and kingdoms and the Kingdom of France. The French king, Charles VIII, swept into Italy with an army of 30,000 men and the most fearsome weaponry ever seen in Europe. Leonardo, 75 tons of bronze, were taken from him and sent downriver to Ferrara to be turned into cannons. And so there's a horrible irony for Leonardo. He's someone who's wanted to build these weapons for Lodovico Sforza. He's been waiting for Lodovico to tap him on the shoulder and say, Milan needs you, Italy needs you, I need you. Build your, for example, giant crossbow. In the 1480s, he was still doing all of these plans for his weapons. I need you to build this, he wanted to have Lodovico say. But in fact, all those years were peaceful. Lodovico didn't need weapons. Then in 1494, when war breaks out, Leonardo is not tapped on the shoulder by Lodovico, who wants him to make his crossbows and dig tunnels under rivers and blow up castles. Instead, he has something quite different in mind for him. And Leonardo gets a kind of consolation prize for losing the bronze equestrian monument. And that is a painting in the Dominican church and convent complex of Santa Maria della Grazia. What Lodovico decided he was going to do about 2 years before this, in 1492, was to inter himself and his wife and his children later in the church. He was essentially taking a leaf out of the Medici book, because the Medici, for the previous three generations, had all been buried in the church of San Lorenzo in Florence, where you can still see their graves. Lodovico, and they rebuilt the church and took over the patronage of it. Lodovico did exactly that with Santa Maria della Grazia and decided it was going to become essentially the family crypt, the family mausoleum for the Sforza dynasty. And he would go once a week and dine in the refectory with the Dominican friars in a kind of show of piety, an act of piety. And during one of these meals, he must have realized that there was a blank wall that needed painting. And he thought, I know just the person to do that. And of course, that's Leonardo. But in many ways, Leonardo in 1494 was not just the person to do it. And in fact, Leonardo objected to it. He wrote a letter to Lodovico, which he then, it seems, ripped up in the days before email you could do this. He ripped up his letter of complaint that he wrote to Lodovico Sforza. But he complained about having lost the bronze horse and being given another task that he was ill-suited to. And I think it's almost certain that he was talking about doing the painting in Santa Maria della Grazia, because it was prestigious insofar as it was a ducal commission, but it was less conspicuous than the bronze horse. If you think about the bronze horse, that giant colossus was going to be sitting in the middle of the piazza in Milan. Everyone who came to the city was going to see it, and people were going to come to the city just to see it, because it would have been so miraculous. Instead of getting that, he is sent into a convent and given the task of painting a wall in a room, very small, dingy, dark little room, where a band of friars eats their gruel every day. And that seems to have been much less appealing for him. The task was also unappealing to him, excuse me, because he was ill-suited to it. If you were asked to paint a wall in the 14th, 15th, 16th century, what that meant is that you were going to paint a fresco. And Leonardo had no experience in fresco, as I said, and what's more, it was ill-suited to his manner of working. This is an image of the way a frescoist worked, in this case Giotto, about two centuries earlier. The Italian word for fresco, affresco, has at its root the word fresh, which is a reference to the way in which the painter worked on moist plaster. So every morning, the plaster would turn up for work and spread all over a field. For example, the field marked number one, in Giotto's fresco, he would spread plaster on it. Giotto and his assistants then had 8, 10, 12 hours, depending on the conditions, to get their pigments onto the wall before the plaster dried. So they had to work very, very quickly. Frescoes had to work at great speed. And once they finished that, once he finished the top left-hand corner, number one, he would then, on the following day, have the plasterer come in and do field number two. And he would then have 8, 10, 12 hours to get his pigments onto that. The beauty of it, the reason why painters worked in this style, is that the pigments were undiluted with anything except water. And when the plaster dried, they became part of the architecture, part of the wall. And therefore, they were extremely durable. And this, of course, was the medium in which all of the great artistic reputations had been made. For example, Giotto's reputation, or painters like Masaccio in the 15th century. But it was full of logistical difficulties and problems, and you needed to train for many years doing it. It was a highly specialized task, and Leonardo didn't have the relevant experience. There's an interesting comparison with Michelangelo, because in 1506, when he was first told he was going to have to fresco the vault of the Sistine Chapel, he had some experience, maybe a year's worth of experience in fresco, but he had not worked in fresco since the late 1480s, almost 20 years. And so what Michelangelo did was he sent to Florence from Rome to find a team of frescoists who could show him how to do it. He went to his friend Francesco Granacci, and Granacci rounded up some people from Domenico Ghirlandaio's workshop, and they came and showed Michelangelo how to do it, and actually did a fair bit of painting early on in the campaign. Leonardo didn't do that. He didn't do it because fresco was ill-suited to his way of working. His reputation as a painter, such as it was, came from the way in which he built up layers. He built his paintings up in layers. He worked very slowly. He was concerned with nuance, with gradations of tone, and with expression. And everything in his nature resisted going very quickly. And so he decided that he wasn't going to do it in fresco, and he was going to try another method, which I'll talk about a little bit later. So Leonardo, in 1494, is dreaming of blowing up castles and building bridges and tunneling under moats, etc. And instead, he gets this job to paint a wall that's 30 feet wide by 15 feet high. Those are the dimensions of the painting that he's going to do. And as I say, you wouldn't bank on him finishing that, because these altarpieces that are 4, 5, 6 feet wide, he's not finishing. How is he going to paint something that's 30 feet wide in a medium that he has absolutely zero experience in? So the question is, how did he begin? I'll talk about his technique, as I said, in a couple of minutes, but mentally he seems to have prepared himself for the task when he realized he couldn't get out of it by doing something very particular, very specific, because at the end of 1494 he bought a Bible. Leonardo kept very close track of all of his books. He was a great bookworm, and he built up, actually for the day, a very impressive library. And in 1494 he bought a Bible. And I think that's very revealing, because generally what you did in the 15th century when you were asked to paint a nativity scene or a crucifixion or a Last Supper or any biblical scene or even a mythological one is that you would go and look at other paintings and take your cue and your artistic guidance from them. And you wouldn't, of course, make an exact copy of them, but the history of art really is an echo chamber, and these painters would bounce off one another. And so Raphael's early paintings, for example, are very, very similar to Perugino's, Perugino being his teacher. But Leonardo didn't want to work that way. And in his treatise for painters, he wrote a book for painters, an instruction manual that he wanted to publish, but ultimately, of course, he didn't get around to finishing it like so many other things. And so it never did see the light of day until long after his death. But in that, he continually stressed that you must not copy other painters. What he wanted them to do is to immerse themselves in the story and then go out into the streets and find people that they could use in their paintings. And so what he wants to do is get literally the gospel truth of the Last Supper. And so he buys the Bible, and I think it's likely he read the four versions of the Last Supper and the four Gospels. And what he discovered was a very intense, dramatic, exciting story that was different from anything he had seen painted. Last Suppers were usually very sedate scenes because they were in refectories for the most part, where silence was to govern. There could be no speaking. The rule of Saint Benedict stressed that all friars had to take their meals in common, but they couldn't speak as they did so. The only one who could speak was the reader of the table, which is why in some Last Suppers, including one by Perugino, you can see someone with a book reading. And so it's an imitation, a reflection of the refectory. But Leonardo throws all of that out and decides that what he sees is something very different. Because if we think of that story, what happens leading up to the Last Supper and after, you've got this charismatic leader with a band of brothers, these 12 men that he's personally picked, and upon whom he's endowed special powers to heal the sick and to cast out demons, etc. And they're sitting down for a solemn feast in the middle of an occupied city whose authorities are plotting against them, waiting for their moment to strike. And all the while that this is happening, sitting among them, breaking bread with them as a traitor. So I think Leonardo decided there's going to be some drama here that none of the other ones have captured. And I think it appealed to him, this scene, because of his interest in capturing the interactions between and among men, groups of men and women. He wrote in his treatise for painters a very interesting comment about the way young painters should proceed. And one of his pieces of advice was to go about and constantly observe, note, and consider the circumstances and behavior of men in talking, quarreling, laughing, or fighting together. So what he said is go out into the street and look at real people acting out real life situations, or not acting them out, living them. And it would have been very unusual to see painters sketching in the open air like that, because generally you took your cues, as I said, from other painters, from pattern books, from model books, things like that. Leonardo said, no, we want to have real people in our paintings. And Leonardo, it said, went around Florence and Milan with a notebook on his belt. He never left home without it. And if he saw someone with an interesting face, he would follow them through the streets and make a sketch of them and then go home, try to commit their features to memory, and then go home and work it up so he could have this unique-looking individual in his painting and not someone who looked like every other person in every other painting. And the fact that he did this, and the fact that if you had dinner with Leonardo or if he saw you in the street, you might unwittingly end up in one of his paintings, is indicated by these little vignettes in little sketches like this, which may have been made in the open air, but also expressions like, Cristofano de Castiglione has a fine head, he writes in a memo to himself. Or Giovannina, fantastic face, is at Santa Caterina at the hospital. And so these are people that he wanted to use in his painting or thought he could learn from. He could learn gesture and expression. One of the things he told young painters to do was to watch deaf mutes, because he said they cannot speak, and here they have to communicate through gesture. And so he said, make a careful study of them, and you'll understand how to make your painting speak, because the figure in your paintings are dumb as well. They're unable to speak. And so you have to make them come alive through gesture. And so Leonardo began work by, sadly, there are very few of his drawings for the Last Supper that survive. Luckily, there are some beautiful drawings of the apostles, of their heads. And I think it's clear from these drawings that they are real people and that he based the apostles on living beings and didn't just call up something from memory or copy a Perugino painting. And so one of the things that I wanted to look at in the book was where Leonardo got his models from. Who are they? And I was intrigued by a comment from someone who saw the painting in about 1510, less than 20 years after Leonardo finished. And when he looked at that painting, he saw not only Christ and the 12 apostles, but also Milanese high society. He said, what you see in Santa Maria della Grazia is a portrait of the illustrious citizens at the time of Ludovico Sforza. So, which gives us a clue about a number of things. In the first place, that Leonardo is using real people. But secondly, one of the things he's doing in the painting, but only one of the things, is glorifying the court of Ludovico Sforza. He's putting great luminaries of the court in. In the book, I try to identify a number of them. One on the lower left, I think, is almost certainly Donato Bramante, from the facial similarities. In the book, I show images of Bramante next to this. Bramante was the great architect, ultimately the designer of St. Peter's in Rome. And he was a very good friend of Leonardo. There are other ones that we have even more concrete information about. I'll just go through a couple of them. But interestingly enough, one of them is the figure of Christ. Leonardo wrote a couple of notes about who he was going to use for Christ. Christ was a composite figure, someone for the hands and someone for the head. And so one of his notes says that he's going to use the hands of someone named Alessandro Carissimi de Parma in the Last Supper. And so the hands of Alessandro are absolutely key. The hands of Christ are key to the painting. Everything in the painting pivots on the hands of Christ, as I describe in the book, and on gesture in general. I think no one in the history of art has ever been as attuned to the expressive possibilities of the human hand as Leonardo was. And so clearly he Alessandro was a young aristocrat, and Leonardo seems to have known him quite well and eyed up his hands and thought he had very beautiful, expressive hands, and therefore he was going to use him. Not just any hands would do. They had to be those of Alessandro. The head was someone else, what seems to be an unlikely candidate in some respects. Leonardo's notes say that he uses someone named Giovanni Conte, and for generations, no one knew who this was until in the 1990s, an Italian scholar put forward what I think is a very plausible candidate, because there was a Giovanni Conte in the entourage of Ascanio Sforza, the brother of Lodovico. Ascanio, you would recognize, not because of the cardinal's robes that he wore, but because of the fact that he was dressed in a suit of armor. He had an entourage of 3,000 mercenaries with him, and one of them was Giovanni Conte. He was a mercenary captain who the next decade then went on to work for Cesare Borgia. And so Leonardo uses his features apparently for those of Christ. And so there's the irony of Christ, the Prince of Peace, being modeled by a soldier, a man who ultimately works for one of the most brutal warlords of the age, Cesare Borgia. There are a couple of candidates for Judas. I'll give them in descending order of possibility. This is a Leonardo's sketch for Judas. And the first candidate is someone, it actually comes from a very good source, a man named Giambattista Giraldi, whose father knew Leonardo and whose father actually stood on the scaffold in Santa Maria della Grazia with Leonardo. He told his son a story, which his son then wrote down many years later. And the story is that Leonardo began looking for a model for Judas, and he wanted to find someone whose features would be adequate to represent the vileness, the viciousness, the evil of Judas. And so he started going into one of the very poor areas of Milan to find someone who was very degraded, an area called the Borghetto, in the northeast corner of Milan, just outside the walls of the city, a very poor area. And this seems quite plausible based on what else we know about Leonardo, that he actually wanted to match the facial features of the person with the character of the figure in the painting. And so apparently he, according to Giraldi, he wandered around every night for a year looking for someone with the features of his Judas. Alas, we don't learn whether he found him in the Borghetto, or if so, who he was. So we're left hanging, and we really know more about Leonardo's modus operandi than we do about who might have modeled Judas in this case. But I should point out that the Borghetto should not be confused with the ghetto. It was not a Jewish area. It was more of a slum area, and Leonardo, by going there, by no means guaranteed himself a Jewish model, and it doesn't appear that that was foremost in his thinking. Later, Last Suppers would have deliberately Semitic-looking Judases, and Last Suppers ultimately became quite anti-Semitic, because Judas, of course, is the betrayer of Christ, and church fathers like St. Jerome tried to say that the word Jew comes from the word Judas, and that there's a great link between the two. There's a second candidate for Judas. This story is probably apocryphal, but like many apocryphal stories, it's quite a good one, so it's probably worth telling. The story has a ring of truth. The story is that Leonardo is not making very quick progress on the Last Supper, which does seem plausible enough. The prior began to get anxious, because after all, Leonardo's scaffold is up in the place where they're eating their dinner every day, so they can smell paint, there are painters coming and going, etc., etc., and he wants it over with. And he watches Leonardo work and finds his way of working very strange. He says that Leonardo will come in some mornings and work very quickly for about a half hour and then leave. Other days, and then often not be back for days on end. Then he'll come in on another day and just look at the painting, add a few touches, and then leave and be gone again for a couple of days. All of which tells us that he's not working in fresco, because you cannot paint a fresco in this way. So the prior goes to Lodovico. He wants his refectory bank. He goes to Lodovico and says that Leonardo was taking much too long. When is he going to make an end of it? So Leonardo is frog-marched up to meet Lodovico and explain himself, and which he does. And he tells Lodovico that the prior wants him to be working like a gardener hoeing in the garden. But he said men of genius are different than that. Men of lofty genius often work the most when they appear to be working the least, which is a very good excuse to have when you're caught staring out the window when you should be working. And Lodovico apparently laughed at this and said, yes, yes, you're right. Don't worry about the prior. I'll take care of him. But Leonardo then apparently says, if he keeps harassing me, I'm going to use his features for those of Judas. And I think the story is apocryphal. It's a very old story. It first dates from a couple of decades after Leonardo's death. But I'm suspicious of it because exactly the same story is told, also with this great tradition about Michelangelo. Because if you've been in the Sistine Chapel and looked at the altar wall, and if you've been on a guided tour, the guides inevitably point to the devil in the lower right-hand corner and tell the story about how the master of the Sacred Palace, the man in charge of enforcing theology in the Sistine Chapel, got angry at Michelangelo taking so long, and Michelangelo had an argument with him and supposedly then turned his features into those of the devil to get his revenge. The two stories are very similar, which I think makes it so that probably only one of them could be true. A last thing before I wrap up, a question for you. What food is being eaten, maybe A, in the Last Supper itself or Last Supper paintings, B, in Leonardo's Last Supper? Can anyone answer either or both of those questions? Okay, yes. Bread and wine are always on the table in every Last Supper painting. Sorry? In the Last Supper? Not quite a bowl, but there is fruit. You're right about that. And I think I heard someone say lamb, which is what we would expect to see. A lot of Last Supper paintings had lamb on the table because three of the four Gospels say that this is the Passover feast. Christ tells them, make the pash. And so presumably they get a lamb. Judas is the man with the purse, and he distributes the money. They go out and get a paschal lamb. And Luke has the wonderful symbolism of the slaughtering of the Passover lambs compared to the slaughtering of Christ, the Lamb of God. John, though, says it's not a Passover feast. He makes it clear that it's happening before that. He disagrees with them on that point. But most painters of Last Supper in the 14th and 15th century would show a lamb on the table or what looks like a chunk of meat of some sort. Leonardo, though, gives something quite different. Does anyone know? It is fish. It's and to be more specific, it's eel. And so Leonardo famously was a vegetarian, one of the most famous vegetarians in history. And so it's interesting that he gives, I guess not exactly a vegetarian meal, but a pescatarian meal to them. Leonardo himself maybe was actually a pescatarian because eels do appear on his shopping list. It appears to have been a meal that if he didn't enjoy, he enjoyed preparing it for other people. It was said he didn't eat anything that had blood, and he was certainly opposed to eating anything that had been alive. But he appears possibly to have made it the exception in the case of fish and eels, things like that. Eels, we don't eat much today. Has anyone eaten eel? Oh, you have. Oh, there's far more people than I would have expected. Is that a San Francisco delicacy? Or? Oh, right, of course, yes. It has, in the Middle Ages and Renaissance, it had the connotation of luxury. If you went to a banquet, a feast, eels would inevitably be served. And you might be aware of the way in which a king of England, Henry I, died of a surfeit of eels, eating too many eels. And Pope Martin IV was put into hell by Dante in Dante's Inferno because of the fact that he was gluttonous. He loved eels marinated with Vernaccia wine. And so Dante accused him of gluttony. And eels had this connotation of lavishness, luxury, and gluttony. And they were served at banquets at the court of Lodovico Sforza. I found references to Lodovico's wife going out and catching eels, which she then brings back for Lodovico to eat. So it's something that if you were invited to Lodovico's table, you would have eaten. And so, as I was saying before, the painting is in many ways a celebration of the lavish court of Lodovico Sforza. So you have the cast of characters from Lodovico's Milan eating a meal that you would have seen if you were lucky enough to be invited to the Castello. But there might be one other aspect to it, and that is that there is a cruel joke being played on the friars by Leonardo, because Dominican friars fasted for a good part of the year. And when they weren't fasting, their food was an unappetizing gruel. There's a story of one painter, Michelangelo's teacher, Domenico Ghirlandaio, painting for a group of friars, and the food was so bad that Domenico's brother Davide actually attacked the monks because he said, the food is appalling, you're treating us so badly. And yet this was their everyday fare. And so once a day, twice a day, the friars file into Santa Maria delle Grazie's refectory and sit down and are served up their swill to eat. And they look up and see this beautiful mouth-watering dish that Leonardo has made. And it's interesting that there were many descriptions, many comments that people made in the first 40, 50 years after Leonardo painted. And then actually in later centuries, including up through the 18th century, and what all of them mention is the food and how realistic it looks. For example, the orange, this is eels and oranges, eels drizzled in oranges. And I found a recipe for that. It was a Tuscan dish. The friars would come in and see this beautiful mouth-watering delicacy. Even the pith in the oranges was painted by Leonardo. And as I describe in my book, no food had ever been painted so realistically before this. This is something we've lost sight of completely, the fact that the Last Supper is, in many ways, a brilliant still life, along with everything else that it is. Just to wrap up then and finish the story, Leonardo, for the first time, and perhaps the only time in his life, managed to focus all of his restless, brilliant energy on one task at hand. And over the course of 2.5-3 years, he managed to finish the Last Supper. Lodovico appears to have been extremely happy with it because of the fact that he gave Leonardo a bonus. He gave him, besides paying him his salary, there's disputes about how much he was paid, but he appears to have been paid very well for it. But he also gave him a little house and a vineyard outside the walls of Milan in a very upscale suburb that was growing up at that time. And Leonardo was delighted with this and kept it for the rest of his life. But the story of the Last Supper isn't really a happy one. It was celebrated for the first 20 years of its existence because no one had ever seen that kind of nuance, that intensity of emotion, the intensity of color as well. Because Leonardo did not paint it as a fresco, as I've been saying. What he did was he painted with oil and tempera on a dry wall. And every single painting manual of the 14th and 15th century told you not to do that. It said that your paint will flake off the wall if you do it. If you want your colors to last, paint in fresco. But Leonardo didn't do that. He thought that he could come up with a magic formula, a secret recipe that would allow him to paint on dry plaster. And the result of that was that he was able to work on his painting in a way that no one worked on a wall painting before, building up very slowly. In some places, he built up 5 layers of color. A frescoist could use 1 layer. And he would use glazes and things like that to give it greater luminosity, intensity, greater saturation. And also, he was able to paint facial expression in the way that no frescoist could have done. Hands, all of the details were just much, much more lifelike. But of course, the trade-off is that the painting did flake off the wall. He didn't, in fact, find the magic formula of how to paint on dry plaster. And in Leonardo's own lifetime, by 1515, someone points out that it's beginning to come off the wall. And by 1580, it's described as a total ruin. And what ensues then is a situation that is extremely, makes very unhappy reading because they bring in various restorers in the 17th and 18th century and they use solvents and glues and try to bring it back to life, but in fact end up doing much more damage to it because they don't know anything about Leonardo's technique. And so they just sort of apply. One of the things they use, one of the least damaging things they use is Greek wine, because the Italians thought the Greek wine was undrinkable, but it was a good solvent. And so they would scrub frescoes and paintings with it. And they also repainted the work. And so if you saw it in the 19th century, you didn't see a lot of Leonardo. You saw a lot of the restorers. And some of them were actually quite bungling. One, ironically, was named Michelangelo, but shared nothing with Michelangelo except his name. And he turned the foot of Bartholomew on the far left into a chair leg, and the hand of Thomas into a loaf of bread, which shows how, A, he didn't do his research into the painting and look at the many reproductions of it, but, B, it shows just how illegible the painting had become by that particular time. And then there's the doorway, the top of which we saw on the tattoo. And you might ask yourself, why didn't Leonardo just raise his painting up a couple of feet to clear that doorway? And the answer is that doorway did not exist in the 1490s when he was painting. It was cut into the wall in 1652 when the friars wanted their meals to arrive in a more timely fashion from the kitchen. And so they cut a direct route from the kitchen into the refectory. A few years after that, over a century after that, Napoleon used it as a stable. When he invaded Italy, the Last Supper, or the refectory, became a stable, and so there were horses, straw, manure, everything in there. After he left, it flooded, and water sat 2 feet deep for 2 weeks. Mold grew on it. It reached its most perilous moment in August 1943 when a stray RAF bomb-friendly fire came down and hit the refectory, knocked out the vaulting, and took out a wall. And if you're wondering where the Last Supper is, was protected by the tarpaulin only for a fairly limited period, or for a fairly prolonged period of time before they could rebuild the refectory. And so it became the world's most famous, the art world's most famous endangered species. But I think as it literally flaked off the wall, it also figuratively came off the wall and became larger. It is now much larger than what we see on the wall when we're there. When we celebrate the Last Supper, we celebrate much more than what you literally see when you're in the refectory, because what we see is a kind of ruin. It's like going to the Roman Forum to understand the grandeur of Rome. You can only get a glimpse of it. But it's had a very vital afterlife, and not least in coffins and tattoos and things like that. Anyway, I'll stop now, and hopefully we've got time for a couple of questions. Yeah. Oh, yes, I should answer that.
Who is the personage to Jesus' right? I've heard people say it's St. John and others say it was Mary Magdalene.
Right. Could we have a show of hands? Well, interestingly enough, I see chapter 12. I write about that in chapter 12. And actually, I happen to have a few images on hand because I anticipated that this question might come up. In the heyday of the Da Vinci Code 8 or 10 years ago, I used to get asked to go around to various groups and talk about the real art of the Da Vinci Code, or the real Leonardo, and look at the paintings described in the book and say whether there was any validity or not to what he was saying. And of course, famously, he says that, or he has one of the characters in the book say that this is Mary Magdalene who appears in the Last Supper. And so I would give a lecture in which I would give the argument of the Da Vinci Code, but I would then go back through art history in this extremely erudite explication of how St. John, because it's either St. John or Mary Magdalene, that's the debate. St. John was the youngest of the apostles and was always shown very young, almost feminized in Last Supper paintings, always without a beard, always the youngest looking. He's on the bosom of Christ. In the Gospel of St. John, he talks about how the beloved disciple, which is him, is the one who is leaning on the bosom of Christ at the Last Supper. And so I would show various other Last Suppers, trying to argue that John was always portrayed in that way. I would describe the relationship between St. John and Christ as described by Christian history. This is the calling of St. John from St. Anselm. Here we see John in the left with Christ. John's on the way to his marriage. This comes from the Apocryphal Acts. John is on his way to his wedding, and Christ stops him and says, John, I need thee. Don't go to the wedding. I'll take you to a higher wedding. And so the two of them, we see with John in the customary pose on the bosom of Christ on the right. And this becomes this classic image of John and Christ together. John usually portrayed in Last Supper scenes or when he's with Christ, not as John the Evangelist long after Christ's death, but he's portrayed as pubescent, a very young man, a very feminine man. These two particular statues, and there are many, many versions of these, were in nunneries. And this was a very popular scene for a nunnery because the women, the nuns, were to identify with St. John because they were the brides of Christ, of course, and John had the same sort of relationship with Christ. And this hand gesture is interesting, the clasping of hands, because that's known as the impalmamento. It's when the bride and groom first are contracted together under Italian law, they would hold hands like that. And so this is a kind of celebration. I would talk in this lecture about the mystic marriage between Christ and St. John, and then I would talk about androgyny in 15th century Italian, specifically Florentine art, through things such as the David and the fact that Italian artists liked that interplay between the male and the female. And the hermaphrodite was a very popular figure in art in the middle of the 15th century, and it's thought that Donatello's David is in fact partly based on that. And then I talk about Leonardo's fascination with gender benders, such as the angel Uriel from the Virgin of the Rocks, or St. John the Baptist, who has many art historians have found a very disturbing figure that does cross that border between male and female. And the question is, why did Leonardo paint like that? But it was his ideal of beauty. Leonardo's ideal beauty was an androgynous young man, a 14, 15, 16-year-old, of whom he had one in his household, who stayed in his household for the rest of his life, Sally, who I discuss in the book, who I think undoubtedly was Leonardo's longtime lover. So I would give my lecture talking about this for 45 minutes or so, and then I would put this image up on the screen, and I'd say, okay, who still believes that's Mary Magdalene? And every hand would go up. So what can I say? I think it's an interesting question. It makes for lovely conversation, but I just think I'm convinced it's St. John. Mary Magdalene is in Last Suppers, though. Fra Angelico put her in a very famous Last Supper. So are we running out of time, Frank?
Yeah.
Oh. Someone did ask about the restoration.
Yeah, no, there's excuse me. Okay. So let me remind the audience that they're listening to Ross King speak about Leonardo in the Last Supper at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco, and there's still time for maybe two more questions.
Someone did ask a question about the restoration, which I should have brought up up to date. It looked much as you see it here, with large passages of paint missing. A restoration campaign, there was one done after World War II for obvious reasons, but in the 1950s, it lasted a couple of years, but it was clear by the 70s, 20 years later, that the work was still degrading. And so in 1977, a 22-year campaign began essentially what the woman named Brambilla, what she did was to remove everything that had been put on after 1497, 1498, all of the repaintings, all of the glues, all of the varnishes, and all of the dirt, soot, things like that, strip it back to the original Leonardo. And then what she did is she herself did a little bit of painting in it to make things match up and try to harmonize it a little more just to make it legible. But crucially, she recorded all of that, and that can easily be removed if in 10, 15, 20 years, there is another restoration campaign. So when you go in there, I mean, it's been argued that what you see now is 20% Leonardo and 80% Brambilla. I think that's probably a slightly unfair ratio, but nevertheless, the work is legible now. You can see what's happening. You can see, for example, that it is eels on the table, That really only became apparent in the 1990s, that that's what Leonardo had given them. And so you can appreciate to some extent Leonardo's genius, but so much of it is lost and sadly, for obvious reasons, will never be recovered. And so we can never get back to that moment in time of 1497 or 1498 when it revolutionized art and everyone was absolutely stunned by it. What we celebrate in some ways is that legacy that it's had.
Hi, I know you write historical novels as well. I'm wondering, did this material ever present itself to you as potential for a novel rather than a historical book?
It didn't. I think, it's been 15 years since I did a novel, so I'm not even sure I could do one again. I'm not sure I can call myself a novelist anymore, or I guess you could never be an ex-novelist, so I guess I can. Some people have told me, people who've written historical novels in the last 10 years or who are writing them now tell me that they're doing it because they wanted to do nonfiction, but they didn't have enough information. And they thought there was a great story here, but if I tweak it and turn it into a novel, I can tell the story that really could be there. For me, the story is there, the story of Leonardo and the Last Supper, because what made it possible was all of Leonardo's writings. We think of him primarily as a painter and maybe as an engineer and as an anatomist, but he was also a writer. And he wrote 6,000 pages of notes, and they were absolutely fascinating to go through and get his opinions on so many things. And so I felt I could bring him alive historically and not invent him. There is a novel done recently, and I'm sorry, I can't remember the name of the author or indeed of the novel at the moment. I blame the cough medicine I took an hour ago. Leonardo is an obvious candidate for novelization. I think there's a film being made about him as well. I'm somewhat leery of doing, I would never myself do that kind of novel. I think my historical novels took invented people and put them in real situations rather than taking a real person and putting them in an invented situation. But I would, just to sum up, I would like to do another novel, a historical novel at some point.
So I guess one real brief question is, if you were presenting your letter of introduction to the Duke of Milan, would you include this, being a historical novelist on your resume? Or
I guess I would have to put it at the very end and say I can write a historical novel as well as any other man.
Exactly. Thank you very much.
He's true as Leonardo.
So ends another event at the Commonwealth Club in its 110th year of enlightened discussion. Thank you very much for coming.